that Biden is fundamentally a Zionist. He believes this stuff. I mean, this is not just the sort of the kind of opportunism that we saw among with Obama, who I don't think was a Zionist, but for very opportunistic reasons was prepared to align himself with supporting Israel on so many things. I think Biden actually believes this. And his embrace of Netanyahu, this defies politics, it defies reality, it defies humanity, that he cannot look at what's happening and even at the level of pragmatic politics say, wait a minute, hold on, let's reevaluate the situation, and at best calls for greater humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. This is unacceptable. And I think that's why it's really important to right now hammer the administration around Palestine.
We're going to have to leave it there, Bill, but we're going to continue the discussion and post online at democracynow.org. Bill Fletcher, longtime trade unionist member of the nation's editorial board, and Jeff Shirky, labor historian, journalist. We'll link to all of your pieces. A very happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon. Here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM. Share with us your memories, experience, and journey of your life. First and third Friday of the month, from 11 to noon, here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO's end-of-year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join. Go to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Cut through the clouds and make it rain to help us meet our $75,000 goal by December 31st.
From applicant tracking systems to chatbots to facial recognition, artificial intelligence is transforming our world for the better and also for the worse. Tune in Thursdays at 9 a.m. for The Imaginary Possible, a show that looks at the captivating potentials and the troubling realities of artificial intelligence today. Only on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for practice.
KBOO.
From KALW's The Spiritual Edge, this is a prayer for Salmon. An audio documentary about the Winnemem-Wintu people and their clash with Northern California's Shasta Dam. I'm Judy Silber.
We need everything's help. We need the salmon's help. We need the birds' help. We need the trees' help. We need the rain's help. We need the wind's help. We need Mother Earth's help.
Even walking through these areas is just putting step by step, like even if it's not like the prettiest part all the time, you know, just by stepping on the land, you have a different relationship.
So you take a place that was this enormous, enormous wetland, and you take 98% of it away. It's a totally different place now.
And, you know, this is called modern living, but with no sense of where is appropriate to live.
America needs to wake up, because this is really what's making us sick.
Winnemem-Wintu Chief Kalene Sisk says most people don't know anything about water.
Yeah, they don't know where it comes from, and they don't know basically anything about water. Most people, surprisingly enough, know only that left handle is hot and the right handle is cold.
Chief Kalene wants the whole state of California to wake up, to understand we need to protect our water. She also wants justice for damage done when the federal government built the 602-foot-high Shasta Dam in the 1940s. It blocked salmon from swimming upstream to prime spawning grounds. Over the next hour, we're going to take you on the run for salmon, a Winnemem-Wintu ceremony that is calling salmon back to the waters above Shasta Dam. The run follows the salmon's migration path. The year I recorded, participants walked, biked, boated, and kayaked more than 300 miles from the ocean to the mountains. We start in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Now! Bye! Goodbye! See you guys!
It's September, already a warm day with the promise of getting hotter. The run for salmon starts out at Segorite on a dirt trail that winds through low hills full of chaparral. Over 2 days, we'll walk a total of 27 miles. We look out at the Carquinez Strait, where the San Francisco Bay narrows before it opens up again.
All life is sacred. Water is life. Water is medicine. Water is sacred.
An elder named Wounded Knee Dale Campo is here. He's Miwok from the Sierra Foothills, one of many allies who support the Winnemem-Wintu on the run for salmon. Wounded Knee is what's known as a long walker, and for much of today, he will walk at the front of the group. He earned the title in 1978 when Native American activists marched across the country to protest policies that took away indigenous rights.
The battle must go on to protect something that's very sacred to everybody that lives on this earth as earth people.
For the salmon we ride, for the salmon we paddle.
At times, the run feels festive. People are chatty, they joke around a lot. But when we're actually walking, the group is often serious, like in a prayer. We walk at a steady pace. Hand drums and ceremonial songs keep us focused. The group is often single file as it winds its way through urban neighborhoods.
Even walking through these areas is putting step by step, like, even if it's not like the prettiest part all the time, you know, just by stepping on the land, you have a different relationship.
Stephanie Dodaro is in her mid-40s, of mostly European heritage, but traveled cross-country with indigenous activists a few years ago. She says walking in prayer is a different way to walk on the land.
You put sweat equity into that. You become bonded with it in a different way, and so you get to appreciate it more as the end result.
Out here, her walking prayer focuses on the run for salmon's goals.
You know, I think about the salmon, I think about the water, I think about everyone has to drink the water, you know, everyone who's affected by, you know, everything that's happening in our environment.
The land we're on is pretty built up. The railroad hugs the shore for a ways. There's military and industrial development, including a CNH sugar plant and a Shell refinery. Also a lot of housing, sidewalks, cars, strip malls, concrete. Winnemem-Wintu Chief Kalene isn't walking with us, but she checks in regularly by car. At one point, she takes note of the surroundings.
It's incredible because this should be marshland. This should all be tules. It should be like almost like the Everglades.
We stand on the street. Cars whip by. She looks out at the boxy houses and wide streets and laments the thoughtless development.
It's like this is such a sensitive estuary that is critical to the salmon in their journey to the northern rivers. The houses everywhere, they've diverted the water system so that the springs don't come up here anymore. And, you know, this is called modern living, you know, but with no sense of where is appropriate to live. And this is what modern living did not consider.
With their footsteps, the walkers want to wake people up to the plight of salmon and to raise awareness about threats to water and their habitat. Here's how Michael Preston puts it.
It feels like I'm doing my purpose in life. You know, this is my job as a dancer and as a Winnemawintu man and human being, to speak up for salmon and water and the land and indigenous ways, indigenous life ways, and the spirituality of it all, and speak up on behalf of all that, and the best we can anyways.
To bring the salmon back, Michael says the Winnemawintu need a lot of help.
We need everything's help. We need the salmon's help, we need the bird's help, we need the tree's help, we need the rain's help, we need the wind's help, we need Mother Earth's help, we need the fire's help, everything, basically, because that's the time right now. The indigenous people have been saying that for a long time, not just us, but around the world, you know, but about what time it is, and it's not looking very great, and that's not a non-optimistic point of view. We are very optimistic, that's why we're doing this.
He's optimistic, but Chinook salmon in this watershed are struggling. Scientists estimate the number of adults that return to spawn is 1/10 or less than what it was historically. To understand more about the habitat where we now walk, I consult with one of California's foremost salmon experts.
Okay, this is Peter Moyle. I'm a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis, working with fish.
Peter Moyle tells me the landscape in and around the Bay Area creates a special environment with a brackish mix of fresh and ocean water, ideal for migrating salmon.
You can see on the map here, this is Suisun Bay. Then you go down over here, you're in the Carquinez Straits. And the Carquinez Straits are so amazing because it's this narrow canyon that then flows into San Francisco Bay, and then the water goes out the Golden Gate. So it creates an incredibly complex estuary.
Salt water is denser than fresh water. So if you think about your chemistry class, they're usually separated out. But these are tidal waters connected to the ocean. The moon's gravity pulls them up and down. It mixes the fresh and salt water together, and that creates a kind of between space where salmon can transform to become either salt or freshwater fish, depending on whether they're coming or going from the ocean. But today, this estuary is not what it once was. Development along the waterway and competing demands for where the water goes has disrupted its natural balance. By early afternoon, we're crossing over the Benicia Martinez Bridge in the eastern section of the Carquinez Straits. The group steps onto a pedestrian walkway. The bridge shakes and hums from the force of cars. It's unbearably loud. The walkers sing, but the noise drowns out their songs. At the center of the 1.2-mile bridge, they stop. They put faces to protective slats, look out at the murky gray water, and say silent prayers for the salmon. I've always welcomed the sight of the Bay Area's waters from a bridge like this. Even with all the development around it, the water inherently gives you a sense of freedom, like you're touching something grand. But as I walked the ground next to the bay, it starts to sink in. that salmon must somehow navigate their way through these less than pristine waters. On the Benicia Martinez Bridge, Becca, the woman charged with keeping the Run for Salmon group moving, says it's time to wrap up their prayers. And then notes, that's a funny thing to say. We cross to the other side of the bridge and go down a small slope.
Tell me where we are.
We are in the Petroleum District in Martinez. We just crossed the waterway into the Petroleum District.
Gary Thomas is a Pomo ceremonial song leader from Lake County, about 2 hours north of where we are now.
I am a descendant of the LM Indian Colony, as well as the Habanapo people, which is my mother's people, which is north of here in Lake County, which we would call Kayabatin, which is big water.
He's here with his son, Gerald. They met Chief Kalin Sisk a few years back. The first Run for Salmon, they came for just a few days. Now they stay and help out the entire 2 weeks. They often walk at the front of the group, where they sing song after song from Pomo country.
What were you thinking when we crossed the water?
Well, the beauty of the ceremony and the song carries us, but then you just can't help but see the devastation. You know, the tankers in the water and all of the contaminants that's going to the bay.
Contaminants he knows are harmful to salmon. We see black smoke floating into the air. It's from the nearby Shell refinery, one of five in the Bay Area. Together, they make up about a quarter of California's total refining capacity.
America needs to wake up because this is really what's making us sick. I mean, indigenous people, as well as every human being on the face of the earth, is suffering some kind of a sickness result of all of the petroleum extraction and everything that's here in this area. It's kind of depressing. So.
Later, I will turn to local indigenous leaders to learn more. They will speak to me about the oil spills and polluted water that make their way into the bay. It's clear none of this is good for anyone, including salmon. The next morning, we continue to head east, doing our best to follow the salmon's migration path. There's no trail along the water, so we walk inland a bit. If this were 200 years ago, we would see herds of deer, antelope, and elk, along with the Ohlone and Bay Miwok people who fished and hunted on this land. Instead, we pass strip malls, gas stations, and tract housing. At different points, the nearly 4,000-foot-high Mount Diablo comes into view. In Spanish, Diablo means devil, but this was a sacred mountain to the native people of these parts, held as the birthplace of the world. The sun low, a small convoy of support cars encourages us with honking and yelling as we finish out the day. We walk through downtown Pittsburgh. Here, you can feel the layers of history that helped shape California's path, where the needs of settlers took priority over those of nature and salmon. During the gold rush, fortune seekers passed through this town on their way to the mountains. Behind us, in the foothills of the sacred Mount Diablo, companies started mining coal. At a small park near the water's edge, Chief Kalin gathers the group in a circle. We can see the meeting place of the two great rivers, the Sacramento and San Joaquin. Here, salmon canneries operated for more than 80 years. To the person next to her, she passes a wooden salmon, a symbol of what they're here for. As it goes around the circle, people speak about their experiences on the walk. Those who touch it express sadness, sorrow, dreams, and hope. The salmon will carry those emotions the whole 300 plus miles to the Winnemem-Wintu homelands on the McLeod River.
Whew, that's a lot.
So much goodness, you know, that's coming through you and coming up through this grounds.
Sacramento San Joaquin River Delta is the next leg of the run for salmon. So far, we've traveled for a few days by foot. This time, we'll be on a boat, moving through the Delta. It's a series of channels and islands, part of a large estuary that starts in the San Francisco Bay and is formed from the meeting of two great rivers, the Sacramento and San Joaquin. In the early morning, a small crew gathers at a marina near the Delta's western edge in a town called Pittsburgh.
We're going up the Sacramento River from the Delta, and we're going to follow that all the way to Sacramento Discovery Park.
Winnemem-Wintu Chief Kaleen Sisk.
We should be getting in there around 1:30 or 2.
We're hundreds of miles from Winnemem-Wintu homelands, but the health of this habitat is critical for salmon. It's part of an indigenous food way, and it's highly stressed. Captain James Netzel steers the small boat out onto the water. The people on board will become quite chatty later, but for now, everyone is quiet. It's a spectacular feeling to be out on the hazy blue-gray water, but there's also a feeling of emptiness. Scientists tell me this unique habitat is probably one of the most altered places on the planet. Of the original 500,000 acres of freshwater tidal marsh, 98% of it is gone. We don't see much wildlife, just a few birds. The edges of this once meandering waterway are sharply defined, an indication of how much it's changed.
I call it a channel instead of river because it's got levees on both sides of it. Makes it look like a big channel instead of a river. Because this should be a meandering river and it should be big and wide, but no, I guess they didn't like that.
Well, once the Sacramento River was big, strong, and unpredictable, it would sometimes flood the entire Sacramento Valley to create a giant inland sea. Then, in the mid-1800s, Euro-American settlers recognized the valley and the area around the Delta as valuable farmland. They piled peat and rocks on the banks to build the first levees. They drained the Delta's marshland. They cut down trees like sycamore and maple and removed the tule, a reed important for birds and fish. Then, starting in the 1940s, the Central Valley Project began diverting water from the Delta to farmers and cities further south. To understand how much the Delta's landscape has changed, I met up with Letitia Grenier, a scientist with the San Francisco Estuary Institute.
So you take a place that was this enormous, enormous wetland, and you take 98% of it away. It's a totally different place now.
She helps me imagine what it was like.
The analogy I've used for it before is that it was the refrigerator of California. It was a place for everybody to come and eat because these marshes are super productive. And so you would have grizzly bears coming, there were tule elk that came, you know, wolves, and there were these incredible runs of salmon as well as other fish that are only found in the Delta. And there were some really amazing accounts of what the early European explorers found in terms of salmon. You know, as the salmon ran upstream, that they were literally like their backs were touching each other.
Adult salmon heading upstream don't eat. They're focused on getting where they need to go to spawn. But juveniles need to bulk up. A young salmon that's big and fat is more likely to survive in the ocean. The Delta offered plenty of food.
So there's algae in the water, phytoplankton, and then there's algae living on the mud at the bottom and living on the stalks of the plant. It's easy to eat and you get a lot of nutrition out of it.
The Delta also offered lots of places where fish could hide or rest in what was an intricate water maze.
If you think about it, we took a marsh that was kind of like the tissues in your body with the arteries and the capillaries and the blood going in and out. And what we did was kind of got rid of all the capillaries, but the big vessels are still there. And this is a big part of the reason why we see salmon doing so poorly. They're essentially running a gauntlet of high velocity water where there's nowhere to rest, there's a lot of predators, and there's not that much food.
On the boat, we continue upstream. Large wind turbines come into view on the left. To the right is farmland. All around us are signs that the demands of modern-day California are prioritized over the health of the Delta.
On the other side of that bush is a warning sign.
Chief Kaline points to a sign on a pole that rises from water near the river's left bank. Gary Thomas is here. He's a steady Run for Salmon presence every year. He reads the sign out loud.
So we're saying warning, don't anchor. Or dredge, natural gas pipeline crossing.
Pipelines are going under the river right here. See that red and white? That's what that is.
CPN Pipeline Company, 877-432-5555.
Between here and our final stop in Sacramento, more natural gas pipelines will cross beneath the water. As we continue on, we see oil rigs set up on land that's dry and stripped of most vegetation. According to a California Public Utilities Commission map, this part of the Sacramento River has over 100 active oil and gas wells. All of this infrastructure makes wetlands restoration difficult and expensive. Gary says after Standing Rock in 2016, where protesters questioned the safety of an oil pipeline, he also thinks about leaks.
Everybody who has plumbing problems in their own home knows that every pipe will leak.
Participating in the Run for Salmon has inspired Gary to consider his ancestral connections to Chinook salmon in Lake County, about 100 miles northeast from here. Restoration efforts have returned salmon to the lower part of a waterway called Poudre Creek. When Gary heard about the fish there, he started to connect the dots.
And then I realized that Poudre Creek kind of went flowed all the way into Lake County, actually. And then started asking around. And a lot of the elders said, yeah, they were runs at one time when they were younger time, so.
He tells me because he didn't grow up with salmon, he's had to work at developing a taste for the fish.
At first, you know, because I didn't really have a taste for salmon. And then you realize the diet we have nowadays, you know, we don't have that consistency of having salmon in our diet, so that was pretty real disheartening.
Removing salmon from the diets of indigenous people has had serious consequences. Karuk people in the far north of California have helped to document the harm. I spoke by Zoom with Karuk ceremonial leader Ron Reed.
My colonial name is Ron Reed, and my Karuk name is Mkaka.
Karuk territory is in the Klamath River Basin, where salmon runs were once prolific. All of that changed in the course of Ron Reed's lifetime.
I'm a traditional dipnet fisherman. I used to fish for the ceremonies, for our elders, for our community, but more importantly, I used to fish for my family, my extended family. Now I'm unable to fish for my extended family, unable to fish for my family, unable to fish for the ceremony, unable to fish for the elders, unable to fish for the community. That puts us in the same situation as the Winneman went to right now.
He and a University of Oregon professor teamed up to do some research. They collected data that indicated increases in diabetes and obesity and strains on mental health, all caused by the salmon's decline. What happened to his community gives Ron Reed empathy for other Native people who have experienced similar losses.
I feel for the Winneman Wintu. I feel for other tribes up and down North America because they've been forcibly removed from their lifestyle and put in existence that we are less than human.
For everyone on the fishing boat, pondering the state of salmon is painful. These waters once supported one of the most diverse and plentiful Chinook fisheries in the world. Captain Nutzel tells me that even in his lifetime, the numbers of salmon on the Sacramento River have gone down.
And we used to have 10-mile-long schools. I mean, just 10 miles of fish from, like, here to Sacramento would just be solid line of fish going in. And now we got little pods of 50 or 60 fish.
Chief Kaline says salmon shouldn't be so scarce.
Really, we should have a paradigm shift where we are, the economy of California should be based on the salmon and not on GMO farming.
When I first heard Chief Kaline say this, I was blown away. The California I grew up with is known for Silicon Valley technology and Central Valley produce. But before dams took over the state's major rivers and streams, we were a salmon state. Salmon could be found from the mountains to the sea.
And so that's why we're saying, like, what are the effects of this waterway? And considering what could be done, you know, if people knew, and if salmon were important enough, you know, what could we do?
We're going to turn our engines off, and we'll see which way the river takes us.
Our small boat is approaching our final destination in the city of Sacramento. We're maybe 100 yards from the entrance to what's called the Delta Cross Channel. It's a channel that diverts water from the Sacramento River and sends it south, and is an important example of the way water is routed away from the Delta. Captain Nutzel turns off his motor. He has a point to prove, that the channel can pull young salmon off their migration path.
And I'll tell you, 99% of the time, if there's no wind blowing us the wrong direction, we'll get sucked into the channel. And we're a 23-foot boat. Think about a little salmon smolt that's an inch long.
The Delta Cross Channel's gates aren't always open, but when they are, salmon can get sucked in from the force created by pumps. When this happens, the young juveniles never make it to the ocean. They never return to lay eggs and reproduce. It's one of the more controversial aspects of how the feds and state handle Sacramento and Delta waters.
This water right here is being diverted. This, see the gates right there? They're up. And so that means the Delta pumps are on. So it's pulling water down this channel. And that's how the fish get confused.
Dan Bacher is another journalist on the boat. He says this is where California's water systems get really crazy.
Aqueducts, canals, you know, pumps, channels, gates. I mean, it's really complex. It is so complex, you got to look at the map of the Central Valley Project and all the different facilities. I mean, they take water from one river, they divert that, dry it up, then recharge that.
I've done a lot of staring at those maps. The way human engineering reroutes the flow of water is mind-boggling. But the biggest takeaway is this. Today, only about 50% of water that should flow through the Delta makes it out to the ocean. That's what's left to maintain this habitat and the San Francisco Bay. The rest goes to cities and farms. As we continue upstream, we see irrigation pipes casually plopped into the water. Also, construction of new levees. And an invasive plant that's choking tall trees that shade the water. All stresses on a river that's still home to salmon.
Does it make you crazy that people do all this work to create what nature already knows how to do?
Right. And it creates these, I don't know, people look at that as jobs. Right? Those are people's jobs, to do all of that nonsense. And we're doing more destruction than we are doing help.
We disembark at a dock in the city of Sacramento, the state capital, and the place where so many of the current laws and regulations controlling this river got a start. A group of Winnemawintu and Run for Salmon supporters greet us with a song. The song says they're getting ready to win the battle to bring salmon back, to see them thrive again on the Sacramento River, to once again become part of the ecosystem on the McLeod River, where the Winnemawintu's ancestors live. Chief Kellen says they don't know how it will all turn out, but despite the obstacles they've observed on the boat, they have to play to win. Over the next few days, the Winnemawintu will rest and then continue up the river on another boat. When this human journey gets hard, when bodies get tired or personalities collide, or when they realize how hard it will be to bring about change, Chief Kellen reminds the group of the salmon's travails. From ocean to spawning grounds, they swim hundreds of miles. They navigate the natural and human-made obstacles. They expend all their energy so their progeny can repeat the cycle of life. They never give up, she says.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Holy.
The Run for Salmon has arrived near the university town of Chico, about 140 miles north of the San Francisco Bay Area. To get here, we've made our way on foot and by boat as we follow the salmon's migration path up the Sacramento River. We'll now switch to bikes. From a community stockpile, Winnemawintu Doug Schofield and his cousin Jared Ward choose a tandem.
Tandem is a little difficult. You gotta learn how to work with your people. We haven't learned that yet, so he keeps trying to go left and I keep trying to go right.
I'm just trying to hold on.
But if we're gonna get these salmon back, we need to learn how to work together. It may take a couple wrecks.
I suspect most Californians don't think too hard about the state's history and its takeover by Euro-American settlers. But for indigenous people, it's hard to forget. To help us understand, here's Lila June Johnston, an indigenous scholar who is trying to find ways to reconcile past and present.
I think that a lot of people boil down history to, well, humans conquer humans. It's just a part of nature, and it's just happened throughout history. So sad. It's in the past. Let's move on. Let's pretend you made a meal for me the day before and fed me and were kind to me. And the next day, I barge into your house take everything, beat you up, kick you out, call you primitive on the way out, you probably wouldn't say, oh, that's just human nature. You wouldn't say, you know, it just happens. You would say, Lila, that was mean, and we deserve some justice here, and let's not forget about that, and let's make things right, right? Like, give me my house back. So for Native people, it's about reclaiming our languages, our identity, reclaiming our worth, and reclaiming our own destiny. And on the non-Native side, it's about being humble, respectful, listening, honoring the fact that Native peoples are the original and foremost scientists of this land, and we probably should follow their leadership.
Hey, hey Tunani, hey Tunanam. Hey, welcome to occupied Machuta territory. You are welcome here.
Ali Metters Knight, a Machupta tribal member, speaks at the outdoor concert put on by the Run for Salmon. She tells the audience seated in front of a makeshift stage about her people's connections to the Chico area.
And I explain it as a territory because a lot of time people say, oh, you're Machupta, this is your land. I'm like, oh, I don't own land, I don't own anything. But as far as territory, yeah, I have a lot of responsibility. We have, for the last 150 years, dealt with the onslaught of colonization. Not only the colonization of the people, but the colonization of the land. And in that, we have done a lot of destruction.
The Machupta have lived on this land since time immemorial. But starting in the mid-1800s, Mexican land grants began to redistribute it to settlers. Ali Metters Knight says the Machupta haven't forgotten what was taken from them.
When you go through a grocery store and you see groceries and you see magazines and you see lights and you see a checker, that's not always been there. There was a creek underneath there. There was a tree underneath there. There were frogs that lived there. There were a lot of beautiful things that lived there, and it was way better than what you see in a grocery store. It had way more to offer.
The next morning, the group gathers at the entrance to the farm where they spent the night. I approach Chief Kaline's son, Michael Preston, as he sits on his bike, ready to take off.
I got my Run for Salmon baton slash staff.
Michael will ride at the front of the group and carry the baton shaped like a salmon with blue and red feathers hanging down.
Flicker for the volcanoes. And blue jay feathers for the rivers and oceans. That's the bigger prayer journey that the salmon, as well as us, we're a part of, is the fire and water elements that can control our water systems, to control the world, really, and so we're paying homage to that.
Fire and water. These elements are out of balance, he tells me. Over the last few years, California has suffered greatly due to wildfires.
There's not enough of us people who consider fire sacred and pray to sacred fires anymore. And there's not enough people who consider water sacred and pray to the waters anymore. So they're off balance. And so this is part of our rebalancing effort as well for our responsibility as Winnemem Wenzu people to help restore balance to our area of the world.
The Run for Salmon pedals through Chico under the shade of tall trees, almost none of them indigenous to the area. Then we head west toward the Sacramento River. I catch up to Michael Preston at the front of the group. Loud cars and trucks shoot by. We cross narrow irrigation canals with muddied water. We pass farm after farm after farm.
I think those are walnuts. Mostly just people see how big the fields are from the freeway, but if you go back in these back roads, you can really see how much of the land is really being farmed with water-intensive crops.
Nuts such as walnuts, almonds, and pistachios are big business in California, with billions of dollars worth exported overseas every year. Water to irrigate the trees and other crops draws from the Sacramento River or the aquifer below the ground. That's turned water into a scarce resource. It's also completely reshaped the geography here. The valley floor once filled with so much water, it was passable by boat in the wintertime. In the spring, thick wild grasses, wild oat, and clover grew tall. The diverse habitat attracted huge flocks of migratory birds and other animal species, like elk and grizzly bears, which we no longer see. Michael Magliari is a history professor at Chico. He says in the decade that followed the 1849 gold rush, California's population more than tripled.
And those people have to be fed, so commercial agriculture develops with the gold rush. It doesn't follow the gold rush. It's a product of the gold rush.
The new settlers set about draining swamps and bogs, building levees, flattening potential fields, cutting down oak trees, and clearing away pretty much anything that threatened their ability to farm.
There were scalp bounties offered for wolves and coyotes and ground squirrels even in California. It varied on the animal. Grizzly bears and wolves, maybe $10 bounties, coyotes, $5 bounties. They varied.
25 cents for ground squirrels or gophers.
And these would be paid by either the state or by local counties.
The Run for Salmon group pulls into a small rest area close to the Sacramento River. It's hot. Everyone reaches for water bottles. In addition to bikes, the support vehicles are also here. Jared Ward blasts one of his songs from a car speaker. When I'm thinking about the day is full of lighthearted moments like this. Lots of inside jokes and teasing. But the group is also well aware of what took place here. It's a disturbing part of California's history that most people who live in the state don't know much about. Before colonization, California was home to an estimated 300,000 indigenous people. By the 1870s, the population had fallen to one-tenth of that, from disease, malnutrition, forced marches to reservations, and outright massacres.
Everybody wants to play a blind eye and sit back and listen to the propagandized history of this world, of this continent.
Gary Thomas, you may remember from previous episodes, is an Alem Pomo ceremonial singer and here to support Chief Kaleen Sisk.
But what's happening is with all the devastation is all the ancestors are coming up and all the spiritual side is coming up. And because we're so connected now with our spirituality, everybody's absorbing that and feeling that massacre, feeling the animosity that happened to our people a long time ago.
He tells me he feels the spirits of those ancestors and the horror of their experiences.
I have felt it throughout this whole trip. That's my purpose on this, because I'm the one supposed to be singing and praying for those massacred and slaughtered and people that have been up and down this river. The ones that used to feed off the salmon, I'm here to pray for them. That is my position. That's been my position.
About 60 miles from here, near the present-day city of Redding, a large massacre of Native California people took place. American settlers in the valley had raised an alarm about a supposed pending attack by Indians. Captain John C. Fremont and Scout Kit Carson were in the area. They went to investigate. By the Sacramento River, they came upon a large group of Wintus.
Yes, this was about on April 5th, 1846.
Benjamin Madley, a professor of history at University of California, Los Angeles, wrote the book American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873.
And so this is an instance in which elements of the U.S. Army, led by Kit Carson and John C. Fremont, massacred what was probably a group of people who were simply gathered to fish and to dry and or smoke that salmon along the banks of the river.
John Fremont and his men surrounded them and opened fire. Then they charged into the village. One U.S. soldier said, quote, "The bucks, squaws, and papooses were shot down like sheep, and those men never stopped as long as they could find one alive." They also pursued on horseback those who tried to escape, quote, "tomahawking their way through the flying Indians." Madley estimates as many as 1,000 Wintu people or more were killed on that day.
The colonizers often believed or convinced themselves or convinced each other that they had to strike first against indigenous people unless they wanted to wait for indigenous people to strike them and suffer those consequences. So the loss of a cow could lead to the massacre of an entire community.
California's first governor was a man named Peter Burnett.
He publicly declared to both houses of the legislature, and I quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct.
The idea that extinction of Native people was inevitable, even part of God's plan, took root in settlers' minds.
It's much more convenient and acceptable for us to think that something is inevitable than to think that we are committing horrible, egregious crimes. It was for camouflaging the fact that what is actually happening is people are bayoneting babies. They are tying stones around people's necks and drowning them. They are beheading people. They are hanging people. They are shooting people.
He estimates that over a 27-year period ending in 1873, state-sponsored militias, vigilantes, and federal troops murdered as many as 16,000 California Native people or more.
And initially in the research, I thought maybe these are rogue operators. But it turns out that governors and state legislators put the power of the purse behind these operations.
Three bills in the California legislature authorized the spending of more than $1.1 million for militias. The federal government also approved and paid for Indian killing campaigns.
But in addition to getting money, the people who participated were also eligible to get land from the federal government. Because by the Militia Act, if you had participated in a militia operation, you could get land from the federal government. So they were taking land from California Indian people as pay for killing California Indian people. It is pretty awful.
Yeah.
It is awful.
The Winnemem-Wintu also experienced the terror of those killing years. Chief Colleen Sisk heard stories from her elders.
There's a little saying that comes down the line through my grandma. She goes, "We're only here because they were bad shots. Not that we didn't get shot at, but they were bad shots. They missed. That's why we're here." I think about what they did, you know, to just live so that we're here.
These killings are often framed as part of a war between Native people and settlers.
People don't understand. They think you lost the war. You might as well give it up. It's like, what, war? There was no war.
We apologize on behalf of the citizens of California to all California Native Americans.
In 2019, Governor Gavin Newsom issued a first ever apology to the state's Native peoples.
For the many instances of violence, maltreatment, neglect, murder inflicted on the tribes.
He established a Truth and Healing Council to clarify the historical record. Chief Colleen is a member. Part of the mission includes gathering narratives from California tribes. The council is expected to issue a final report in 2025. It may include recommendations for reparations. A few months after Governor Newsom's address, Chief Colleen Sisk and other Winnemem-Wintu are invited to attend the annual Chamber of Commerce State of the City Address in Redding. Mayor Julie Winter is speaking in a large, echoey meeting hall.
The Redding area was settled thousands of years ago by the Wintu people, who were made up of nine distinct bands.
Today, several tribes of Wintu people live in the Redding area, including the Redding Rancheria, the Wintu Tribe of Northern California, and the Winnemem-Wintu. The mayor asks all Wintu present to stand.
I apologize for the grave injustices that were perpetrated on your families. I am grieved that you were not protected by your local government and that your people have suffered to this day.
Chief Colleen Sisk isn't so impressed. She acknowledges it took courage for the mayor to make such a speech, But she grumbles that an apology without substance isn't worth much.
Grandma says apologies are just words. You know, you can say, you know, like in school, they make you say it. Apologize to him. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I said I'm sorry. Well, how sorry are you? I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. But it doesn't fix it, right? So, like she says, you know, if two boys are fighting and the one boy breaks the other boy's arms, then he has to, if he's really sorry, then he'll carry the wood that boy would have carried for the grandmother. He would do that to clean the slate. That's an apology.
She's skeptical of empty promises, empty words. How sincere could this apology be? After all, she says, the Wintu invited to the event had to pay for their own tickets. Apology or not, help or not, she wants salmon back on the McLeod River. The run for salmon continues on. A Prayer for Salmon is a product of The Spiritual Edge at KALW Public Radio. Support for the series comes from the Templeton Religion Trust, California Humanities, the Calliopeia Foundation, Save Our Spirits, and the Water Desk at the University of Colorado Boulder. Our team includes Loretta Williams, Jeb Sharp, Tarek Fuda, Chris Agusa, Tom Levy, Lindsay Myers-Humley, Danya Abdel-Hamid, Adriana Rodriguez, Deborah Kroll, and Katie McCutcheon. Our advisory committee is Mark Dadigan, Joseph Orozco, Brendan Lindsay, Les Hall, and Michael Preston. Thank you to Lila June Johnston for her insightful commentary, and to the Winnemem Wintu and the Run for Salmon community for welcoming us into their midst. The music we're listening to now is In the River by Ray Zaragoza. Until next time, I'm Judy Silber. Thanks for listening.
Our sisters and our brothers, we are camping out for each other. We are stronger when we band together, and we're standing up for the water. Don't poison the future. Mother Earth protects us all. If you treat her with disrespect, then what message have you left for your children and their home?
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kabu.fm.
Why do I think KBOO is important to our community? Well, I believe it is important to our community because of the same reason that I am passionate about KBOO. It provides a platform for people to express themselves. And although this is becoming the norm, especially for the past 10 years and the present time, it is the norm for people to be able to express themselves to a variety of video platforms, either on phones, tablets, and on the internet. The community radio was the medium that I believe pioneered the whole concept of having regular citizens express their ideas and their philosophies, their opinions, and their thoughts on things that are of importance. So that's why I think KBOO remains a very, at least potentially, relevant part of